From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. While America is tied in knots over the Starr Report, humorists are having a field day. On today's Fresh Air, humorists tell us how they're dealing with unprecedented subject matter. We'll hear from political impressionist Jim Morris, satirist Harry Shearer, and political cartoonist Tom Tomorrow. Then we'll talk with Bob Dole about his new book called Great Political Wit. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the hit solo album from singer Lauryn Hill of the Fugees. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Residents of southern Florida are preparing for Hurricane George. 80,000 people in the Florida Keys have been ordered to flee. Even NASA, which lies north of the storm's expected path, is taking precautions. Pat Duggins of member station WMFE reports.
Space Shuttle Discovery is on the launch pad for a mission including the return to space of former Ohio Senator John Glenn. KSC launch managers met this morning with Air Force forecasters to talk about Hurricane George. The agency is thinking about rolling Discovery off the pad just 3 days after it arrived. Additional meetings are planned for later today before a final decision is made. The concern is over heavy winds that could damage the shuttle's heat protection tiles. Lightning is another danger since Discovery's two solid rocket boosters are already loaded with 2 million pounds of propellant. This isn't the first time bad weather has chased shuttles off the pad. Hurricanes Fran and Bertha forced Atlantis to move twice back in 1996. That left astronaut Shannon Lucid stranded aboard the Russian space station Mir an extra month. For NPR News, I'm Pat Duggins in Orlando.
Meanwhile, news reports from Haiti indicate Hurricane George has killed at least 6 people there. The storm is now responsible for at least 27 deaths. The Haitian victims died from flash flooding as rushing water streamed into a Port-au-Prince home. Haiti is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, and it had no money or resources to prepare for the hurricane. The Malaysian government has vowed to bring the country's former Deputy Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim to trial soon. He was fired September 2nd on charges of sexual misconduct. Ryan Mailzer reports.
Police detained Malaysia's former Deputy Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim under the Internal Security Act, which allows authorities to hold people indefinitely without trial. But the Prime Minister, Dr. Mahathir Mohamad, says Anwar will be tried swiftly, probably on charges of sexual misconduct. Anwar was detained on Sunday, along with the few politicians loyal to him in the ruling party. The detentions came shortly after riot police forcefully broke up a demonstration of Anwar's supporters. Prime Minister Mahathir fired his deputy and heir apparent Anwar on September 2nd, alleging that he had engaged in homosexual acts and adultery and endangered national security. But many supporters of the charismatic Anwar believe he is being persecuted because the Prime Minister sees him as a rival to his power. For NPR News, I'm Ryan Meltzer in Kuala Lumpur.
House Speaker Newt Gingrich says it's much too soon to discuss any possible deal for President Clinton to avoid impeachment hearings. Gingrich says lawmakers must first complete their investigation. The Speaker talked with reporters today after Republican and Democratic House leaders met. The Speaker says no one has the full story of the Lewinsky matter, and Congress must work to complete its review of the independent prosecutor's investigation. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up more than 119 points at 8,016. The NASDAQ is up 32. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, stock market investors are focusing their attention on Capitol Hill, where Federal Reserve Board Chairman Alan Greenspan will testify. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
When the chairman of the powerful Federal Reserve Board sits down today before members of the Senate Budget Committee, large and small investors alike will be hanging on Mr. Greenspan's every word. That's because there is growing speculation the Federal Reserve Board, the group responsible for setting short-term interest rates, may now be inclined toward cutting those rates. That could conceivably occur as early as the Fed's meeting next week. Whether this is just the latest example, though, of Wall Street wishful thinking remains far from clear. A rate cut would be viewed favorably by the financial markets as a sign the U.S. is committed to helping boost the world economy. In other news, federal regulators are meeting to discuss the Citicorp Travelers merger today. Drug maker Shearing Plough has announced a 2-for-1 stock split, and Lehman Brothers reported a 23% drop in its third quarter earnings. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
At the end of the federal fiscal year, which is nearly upon us, the Treasury Department says the first federal budget surplus in 29 years will be a reality. The agency reports the U.S. government had a deficit in August of $11.2 billion. That's 68% lower than it was a year ago, and there will be a surplus for the first 11 months of the budget year, worth nearly $32 billion. The American Automobile Association says the average price of a gallon of gas is at its lowest level in more than 6 years. AAA says prices are nearly a quarter lower than they were at this time a year ago. Each month, the association surveys gas prices around the country, and it found that the average price of a gallon of self-serve unleaded was $1.05. That's nearly 2 cents lower than it was in August. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music in more than 200 neighborhoods across the United States, where browsing is a fine art. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The possibility of impeachment hearings is a grave matter, but the Star Report is also providing unprecedented material for America's humorists. We're going to talk to a couple of humorists and see how they're dealing with the story. Jim Morris is a political impressionist who specializes in impressions of President Clinton. He's been featured at the White House and the Washington Correspondents' Dinner. He's also the co-author of White House Confidential, the little book of weird presidential history. We called Jim Morris Monday afternoon after he'd seen the video of the president's grand jury testimony. Now, when you started off doing Bill Clinton in your routine, you were mocking things like Clinton's Big Mac attacks. There's a long, big distance between Big Mac attacks and dealing explicitly with questions about a sexual relationship. So how are you handling this new sexual material?
Well, it's really no different because he is a man of huge appetites. We've all known that already, so none of this comes as a shock to me. What amazes me is how open it's been. The fact that they're airing this stuff, broadcasting it, and it really troubles me that sort of takes the shock value away if I want to do a joke about it. I mean, it's such an easy joke. Sex is easy to begin with for a comedian to get on stage and get big laughs, but these jokes are flying across the internet at lightning speed, and to compete with that and to stay original and to step out of the gutter is a challenge. So how am I dealing with it? I'm trying to get very clever, because you're competing with Jay Leno and David Letterman and all these other folks who are sending jokes over the internet. And you have to be even more creative.
So how are you dealing with oral sex and cigars in your routine? Are you going near there?
Sure. It's very difficult. I always like to work clean, but I can give you an example of how I walk the line. Well, you know, my advice to President Clinton would have been to go in there with Kenneth Starr, with the folks in the jury room, the grand jury, in another part of town. My advice to him would have been to do what everybody else in the country is doing, and that's making fun of the situation. Maybe Clinton could have won some points if he went in there and said, "Look, I know you know that I, you know, wasn't completely truthful. Well, let me go in there and humor the guy." Well, Mr. Starr, that's a very good question, but I have to tell you that she wasn't on my staff at the time. Seriously, folks, I wasn't lying. I was sitting on the edge of my desk. But seriously, folks, my first lady, she wasn't my first, but I married her anyway, and she wasn't my last, as I'm sure you've all gathered. But you, the American people, and especially the folks sitting there watching me on closed-circuit TV, I want the jurors in the grand jury process, I want you all to know, you should have seen this coming. I said when I was reelected that during a second term in the White House, I would not be doing any major redecorating, but that I did want to pick up an occasional piece.
Because of the sexual nature of the presidential scandal, we're hearing a lot of sexual talk in prime time on television, sexual words used in newspapers like never before. And I'm wondering, What that's got you thinking?
Well, it's got me thinking that Bill Bennett's on to something. He's on to a losing battle. I mean, you look at all of prime time. I mean, Fox Network, MTV, and it's filtering out into the major networks now where you tune in and you see, hello, I am Ted Koppel, and this is, you know, and then he says a word, you know, a naughty word. And when you see a news anchor come on and read the news and use these words, it just kind of shakes me up a little bit. Hello, I'm Tom Brokaw with NBC Nightly News. Miss Lewinsky, having accepted the presidential chaperillo, responded, and I quote, honey, do you like it when I... You know, I mean, I just... This is like we're living in a surreal movie, I think. The president's peccadilloes. I do tune into NBC to see him pronounce those kind of words, but I would imagine the other newscasters are wrestling as well with these words that we only use behind closed doors. You figure that certain shows and networks should be safe. I was watching 60 Minutes the other night. You know, a show I can watch with my kids, but I don't know. Andy Rooney comes on, and he says, hello, I'm Andy Rooney. Did you ever look at a prophylactic lately? Why do they call them rubbers anyway? I mean, you certainly can't wear them on your feet. And even if you could, you'd leave awfully strange footprints on the beach now, wouldn't you? You know, I mean, this is stuff that... I mean, my kids can't see this. I'm embarrassed.
Now, Kenneth Starr is such a major part of the story, but we actually hear very little of him directly. You know, we hear him speak very seldom. Have you heard Kenneth Starr enough to be able to do an impression of him?
No, I haven't. And I suppose if I really wanted to, I could tape what little we have of him. You know, I could sling the jacket over my shoulder as I stand in a driveway next to a car. But I try to recognize ahead of time whether or not he will be recognizable enough for the masses so that if I did perfect an impression, people would get it, would understand and say, hey, yeah, that was worth the time. We all know Kenneth Starr. So what I'm doing instead is I'm looking ahead at possible hearings on the Hill, and I'm picking out certain congressmen and eventually senators who will be very visible with public hearings. So I'm working on a Hyde impression, a Conyers impression. There are plenty of others up there. That's who I'm working on right now.
Boy, you're going to have to do a whole committee, huh?
Well, why not? Why not? I could try the president myself. I could try him myself, and I could defend myself as Clinton.
Have you ever performed for the president?
Yes, I have. It was a very impromptu meeting. It was... you want me to tell you about it? It was...
Yeah.
I was meeting with the vice president, and he has a little office in the White House, and he took me by the hand and said, oh, boy, you got to follow me here. And I sort of assumed he was taking me to meet with the president. He was really amused with me, you see. I was doing President Bush in his office saying, hey, how about this, Al? You like this, Al? I was here for 8 years with President Reagan, yet Barber bought me box lunch every day. I really enjoyed it here. So he said, follow me. Takes me into the Oval Office, of all places, and it's just the three of us standing there. Gore to my left, Clinton to my right, clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. And here I am. What do I do? So I just went into character and took over. I was effectively the president for, I don't know, about 10 or 15 minutes. And I remember before I left, I offered the president, I said, do you need me to make any phone calls for you on your behalf? And he said, I can think of a few people I'd like to, yeah, why not? You know, that'd be fun. And, you know, so I was doing shtick in the Oval Office. It was a lot of fun. But if I only knew what I know today, I would have washed my hands on the way out.
Well, you've studied several recent presidents and done them in your act. Do you have any thoughts about what some recent presidents might be thinking about what President Clinton is going through?
Oh, sure. Oh, hold on. Let me put on former President. Mr. Bush?
Hey, how are you? Is this Terry Gross? How are you? You know, I think it's... You know, I don't want to say we didn't want to use any of this during the campaign back in 92, but we knew what he was made of. I think Ron wants to say something here.
Hello? Hello? Yes. Well, God bless you.
I just have to say, back in my day, we never even had fellatio. Oh, no. Why, back then, we had to do just about everything by hand.
Well, Jim Morris, I really thank you for talking with us.
Was it Jim Morris speaking with you? Yes, yes, I was here. Okay. Well, it was nice talking with you, Terry.
Jim Morris is a political impressionist and co-author of White House Confidential, The Weird Book of Presidential History. Coming up, political satirist Harry Shearer. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Satirist Harry Shearer has been chronicling President Clinton's career in an ongoing series of sketches called Clinton Something, which is part of Shearer's nationally broadcast public radio program, Le Show. Harry also has a forthcoming book called Why People Hate Clinton. Harry Shearer is an alumnus of Saturday Night Live and does many of the voices on The Simpsons. We called him to talk about the Starr Report and its aftermath. I think that in some ways the Starr Report and the video testimony is changing how people talk about sex and what they feel comfortable talking about. I'll use myself as an example. I was having dinner in a deli the other night, having, I thought, a fairly loud conversation about oral sex, and the subject of the conversation was the president. And, you know, you don't usually talk about oral sex in a, you know, fairly loud voice in a restaurant.
You that's such a relief. I thought you were going to tell me that they'd already named a sandwich after Monica Lewinsky. I am so relieved.
It's on rye bread.
Yeah, and it's got tongue. I know that. Given what we overhear being talked about loudly in delis out here, at least I would say that would be refreshing change. It's deals, screenplays and deals. Bill Clinton has been nervy enough to say at one of his appearances on the Road to Contrition that he thought this journey he was on was good for Americans, and if you grant him that, I guess one of the ways is that it has got anchormen saying semen stains without blushing, the word semen stains without blushing now, which has been good for them at least.
But, it's interesting. On the one hand, I think people are speaking more openly about sex. On the other hand, there's this feeling that the sex police are out there now.
Yes. Well, I mean, I think that something, maybe the truest thing that was said about this entire case was said very early on when Joe DiGenova, the Republican former independent counsel on his own and known Republican, noted Republican Washington lawyer, said of the independent counsel's tactics in this case, Ken Starr's office is not doing anything that prosecutors around the country don't do every day. I think what people may have felt as they heard these unseen voices in the videotape asking these incredibly intrusive questions after all of the tactics that we've seen is, my God, this could happen to me. And I think, one of the things we've seen is that the heritage of 20 years of widening prosecutorial power in the name of the war on drugs or the war on organized crime has resulted in a sort of a scary deal here.
Well, Harry, the question I've always been meaning to ask you, I guess this is the appropriate interview, how do you define sex?
It depends what you mean by define.
Well, you're somebody who has to deal with language all the time because,
mm-hmm.
you have a very good...
I mangle it for humorous purposes.
Yes, exactly. So what do you think of the definition that was used in the Paula Jones case that the president has had to use?
Well, I think, in a way, one of the things that it was possible to see in the videotape is that a definition that up till now had seemed like it was imprisoning the president in some kind of legalistic artifice of his own devising is in fact something very fortunate that was handed to him by the Paula Jones lawyers. And if, as Jackie Bennett Jr. sort of ruefully asked, if they'd asked him directly about oral sex, would he have answered truthfully? And he said yes. I think it serves as an example of bad lawyering by the people who were representing Paula Jones, that they got themselves boxed into having to live by that definition and didn't see fit to ask the president a direct and clearly worded question at the deposition. You know, we might not be here if they had. Well, I'd be here. I own this place. But...
Were you uncomfortable watching the president's testimony?
No. I was on on the couch for most of it, which is a comfortable place for me. But no, I didn't feel badly for him because he was handling himself pretty well. I mean, I have just gone through my own civil lawsuit, so I know what it's like to testify and to give a deposition. I've been through those circumstances recently. You know, you learn in a situation like that that if you try to be discursive in your answers, two things will happen. Either your lawyer will tell you, don't offer anything, just answer the question, yes, no, or I don't know. And if you try to be discursive to run out the clock, as I think Clinton was in a lot of that, the opposing lawyer will normally say something to rein you in. And I think what was remarkable was that the lawyers from the independent counsel's office, while they asked antagonistic questions and questions that certainly had a prosecutorial motive behind them, to say the least, really didn't have the nerve to say, Mr. President, please just concentrate on answering the question and don't offer me, you know, 3.5-minute explanation. So in that sense, he was very effective in sort of taking control of the situation.
I ask what your case was about?
Oh, I was suing, I'm going to be redundant here, some jerk producers. according to my attorney, it was the only civil case he'd ever heard about that ended in a draw.
Interesting. So, do you are you tired of this story? I mean, do you hope that it ends soon?
Well, I have two feelings about that. As a person who draws comedy from it, I hope it goes on forever. As a citizen, you know, I think that there's nothing is going to be more ludicrous in the annals of American history than the Supreme Court 9-0 decision ruling that a civil case wouldn't disrupt the presidency if it proceeded while the guy was still in office. I think people are going to look back at that case and then what ensued and go, what were those guys thinking?
Harry, you know, one of the people who you're sharing our show with today is Bob Dole, who has a new book called Great Political Wit. And it's a book about political wit over the years, quips and so on made by presidents and presidential candidates over the years. And I'm wondering if you've thought of Bob Dole as a wit.
Yeah, I often thought of Bob Dole as a wit. I thought that was sort of the sad story of his presidential campaign was a basically inherently witty guy who had been told by all his handlers, stay serious, don't do that. And I thought that, you know, the unfortunateness of that campaign was that you could see him straining to keep his natural tendency to wisecrack under control, because it had cost him in previous campaigns. And you get around risk-aversive people in a political campaign, and wit is not risk-aversive. I felt badly for him in that circumstance. And I'm also relieved for him that Newt Gingrich doesn't need his $300,000.
Right. Are you imagining the possibility in the future of hearings in which Monica Lewinsky is called to testify about whether the president really touched her on the breast or genitals?
Well, you see, I think this is... I have a bet with several people that the president will resign sooner rather than later, and that's not based on where I think public opinion is at, but based on my estimate high... that is, of the cowardice level of Democratic members of Congress confronting the prospect that you've just asked about. I just see, in growing numbers, Democrats going to the White House saying, Mr. President, I can't be on national television when those questions are asked, let alone have a staff member of mine put in front of me a question like that for me to ask myself. I can't be in that position. And the last really great thing you can do for the Democratic Party, aside from coming and helping us raise more money, is to not put me in that position. And I see that I foresee that happening more and more as they look into the future and consider that prospect. I think it frightens the hell out of Democrats in Congress.
Bill Bennett said something to the effect that it was okay to put the Star Report on the internet because the material may have been salacious, but it's not titillating.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that you know, the way the Star Report was written, he couldn't imagine anybody reading it and being, you know, aroused by it.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts on that?
I just got a great mental picture of Bill Bennett trying to imagine people getting aroused.
That's the odd thing about this story, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Well, I mean, it does call upon. I think that the first, and I still think the primary danger to President Clinton in the wake of the August 17th speech is, it seems to me that it's still true, and he hasn't disproved it yet, that he's moved beyond the realm of the single entendre, and that's pretty dangerous for a president.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, every time he makes a speech, you know, his writers have to just be on double duty to excise any words that could have anybody in the listening audience muffling a chortle, you know. And that list of words is pretty long at this point. I don't need to be explicit.
Right.
But that's a fairly dangerous position for a president, you know, who's, especially one like this, whose basic, you know, with a Congress dominated by the opposition party, whose basic weapon at this point is words. And so many of his words have been taken away from him because they induce laughter in the listenership.
Harry Shearer. He hosts the nationally broadcast public radio program Le Show. You can also hear it on his website at www.harryshearer.com. His forthcoming book is called Why People Hate Clinton. Here's something Harry put together for last week's edition of Le Show using the voice of Ted Koppel. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This was The Definition. Contact with genitalia, anus, groin, breast, inner thigh, or buttocks of any person with an intent to arouse or gratify the sexual desire of any person. This was The Definition of genitalia. Any anus, any breast, any groin, any inner thigh, any genitalia, any buttocks, buttocks, any inner person, any groinus, any inner talia, any breast tucks, any groin tucks. With anus, any buttalia, any buttalia, any groin talia, any breastness, any inner breast talia, any desire, any desire. Any buttocks, any desire, talia, any anus, any genitals, any genitals, any tucks, talia, any bri, any buttocks, any talia, any talia tucks. Any desire, breast desire, gen desire, thigh desire, groin desire, butt desire, anus desire, talia. This was Groin Tech. This was Gentech. This was AimTech. This was Desire. Desire.
Coming up, political cartoons about the Star Report. We talk with Dan Perkins, creator of the Tom Tomorrow cartoon strip. Also, Bob Dole tells us what it's like to be the butt of the joke. He's written a new book on political wit. And Ken Tucker reviews the hit CD by singer Lauryn Hill of the Fugees. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Dan Perkins is the creator of the syndicated political cartoon Tom Tomorrow. He's drawn the president as saying, "I don't care if I am the most powerful man in the world. I'd give it all up in a minute in order to have sex with that moderately attractive, big-haired intern." And Dan Perkins has drawn Kenneth Starr working up a sweat reading a magazine called Hot Babes while saying, "It is vitally important for the public to know that the president masturbated into his sink." The latest Tom Tomorrow cartoon is on the cover of The Village Voice. Dan Perkins also has a new book called Penguin Soup for the Soul, featuring his Tom Tomorrow cartoons. The internet is filled with Star Report action. Dan Perkins has had his own adventure on the internet with a Kenneth Starr cartoon.
It was when this thing first broke, and Clinton on the NewsHour kept saying, "I did not do that. I did not do that." And the cadence of it reminded me of Dr. Seuss. And I wrote this parody called Star IR, which was picked up right away by the New York Times Weekend Review. And then some chucklehead out there transcribed it and put it online without giving me credit for it. And it went basically to everyone in the United States with an email address. And then by the time the cartoon started running in most of my client newspapers around the country, I had people emailing me accusing me of plagiarizing, myself. But I could read the cartoon here.
Yeah, why don't you?
So it's drawn in a Dr. Seuss style with Ken Starr holding a little sign that says Star IR, and he walks up and says, "I'm here to ask, as you'll soon see, did you grope Miss Lewinsky? Did you grope her in your house? Did you grope beneath her blouse?" And Clinton stands up and says, "I did not do that here or there. I did not do that anywhere. I did not do that near or far. I did not do that, Star you are." And Star in the third panel continues, "Did you smile? Did you flirt? Did you peek beneath her skirt? And did you tell the girl to lie when called upon to testify?" And Clinton ends up in the final panel saying, "I do not like you, Star you are. I think that you have gone too far. I will not answer any more. Perhaps I will go start a war." This was right when it looked like we were possibly going to start bombing Iraq, and then in a tiny panel at the very bottom, Clinton concludes, "The public's easy to distract when bombs are falling on Iraq." Now, this thing went out on the net, and the really aggravating thing was that there are a lot of lazy journalists out there who seem to view the internet as just some sort of vast zone of freebies, that, you know, whenever they can't think of a column idea, they can just go log on and lift something off the net, and easily a dozen columnists. I did a database search, and there were easily a dozen newspaper columnists who ran this thing unattributed. Ironically, the only source that ran it with attribution was the conservative Washington Times. And another odd thing was that it was picked up by a right-wing radio station in Seattle, the Rush Limbaugh affiliate there, and they were using it as their station ID for a while.
Really?
Yeah, so I and it's still floating around. I just got an email the other day with sort of an updated version of it taking into account current events. So it's really taken on a life of its own.
Well, if people have that on their email now, they'll know what the source was.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, you also did a cartoon about Linda Tripp that just kind of questions how could you have shown up in so many places. Why don't you kind of run through what that one's about?
Okay. It starts out saying, "For months, scientists have been puzzling over the mystery of Linda Tripp." And I have these two scientists saying, "She was the last person to see Vince Foster alive. She witnessed Kathleen Willey leaving the Oval Office, and she was Monica Lewinsky's confidant." And the other guy says, "The woman is a statistical impossibility." And I have Linda Tripp at sort of the center of this kind of Twilight Zone-looking graphic, and it says, "Countless hours of arduous calculations have finally yielded a stunning breakthrough. Linda Tripp somehow exists in a focal point of the space-time continuum around which historical events inexorably coalesce." And then it goes on showing her as a young girl with John F. Kennedy plotting out the Bay of Pigs, and she's with Richard Nixon with her trusty tape recorder. And finally, she's whispering into Oliver North's ear at the Iran-Contra hearings, and it concludes saying, "Clearly, further study is urgently needed so that in time we may learn to control this phenomena and find a way to use it to our advantage." And there's an Iraqi soldier escorting Linda Tripp in to see Saddam Hussein, and the soldier says, "Sir, the new member of the inspection team has arrived," and Saddam Hussein is thinking to himself, "I've got a bad feeling about this."
So, Dan, do you think more people read political comics in times like this when people are obsessed with a story?
Probably. As I say, more people are certainly watching MSNBC and Chris Matthews and so forth.
Well, I hope that's good for you.
Well, I really hate to profit by this whole thing. I just there aren't any heroes here, and it's all just so appalling and pathetic. I mean, you know, you think back and during Iran-Contra, you know, this was something, you know, the Reagan administration was running a covert war. This cost tens of thousands of lives. You had Ollie North sitting in the White House basement drawing up plans for martial law, for God's sake. And the Walsh Report, you know, didn't receive anywhere near the play that the Star Report is receiving. And it's, I think basically it's because Ken Starr understands the first rule of advertising: sex sells.
Well, I think it won't be revealing any political bias on my part to say that I agree with you when you express the hope that this scandal will spell the end of the obnoxious cigar craze.
Yeah,
hear, hear.
That was the conclusion to a cartoon recently where I've got a guy holding a cigar saying, "You know, I just can't put one of these things in my mouth anymore without thinking about," and his friend says, "Yes, yes, I know.
Well, Dan Perkins, a.k.a. Tom Tomorrow, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Oh, thank you very much.
Dan Perkins is the creator of the syndicated political cartoon Tom Tomorrow. The new Tom Tomorrow book is called Penguin Soup for the Soul. Coming up, Bob Dole on his new book, Great Political Wit. This is Fresh Air. Bob Dole knows what it's like to be the butt of political jokes, and he also has a reputation for being very funny, even if that's not the side he showed during his last presidential campaign when he was defeated by Bill Clinton. Dole left the Senate during that presidential campaign. He'd served as majority and minority leader of the Senate during both Democratic and Republican administrations. Yesterday, we spoke with Bob Dole about the Starr Report. Today, we talk about Bob Dole's new book, Great Political Wit, Laughing Almost All the Way to the White House. Do you have a favorite joke circulating now about President Clinton's predicament, or are you afraid that that would force you to work blue?
Yeah, no, I don't know. I haven't tried to make any. You never play politics of people's misery, and whether it's personal or hurricane or tornado or whatever, some conflict. I think you sort of have to back off now. Leno and Letterman and all these other people are out. They get paid for this. They can be as irreverent as they want. But I haven't tried to. I've talked about Monica, but in fact, in the book, I have a. You know, we live at Watergate South. We're in 112. She's in 114. I think I've got a little joke in there that I walk by, but always walk by real fast. I don't want to be subpoenaed. So, but that's about the extent of it. But I live in a famous neighborhood. Monica Lewinsky next door. Charlie Tree used to live down the hall. Things of that kind, but nothing that ever would connect Clinton and Lewinsky in some, some off-color situation.
Now, you've been a guest on Letterman and Leno. Before you started guesting on their shows, what was it like to be the butt of the jokes when you were running for office?
Well, I never got to see hear them, but people would repeat them the next day. So, I think one of Leno's would, I've been using Grecian formula so long, I got it from the original Grecian or whatever, all this stuff. It's kind of funny. I mean, you got to be able to laugh at yourself. One thing I've learned over the years, and I think I've always had a reputation, my colleagues, sort of being funny in the sense that a sense of humor could kind of save the occasion or lighten the occasion. But you learn early that you don't make fun of people in your jokes. I used to tell a story about having a head injury in the war and then going into politics. But I had a letter from, I can't remember the exact name, but represented people with head injuries. And, of course, they were offended by this. This was 25 years ago, and I stopped using it. It never occurred to me that even though I thought it was funny, and the audience always laughed because it was sort of poking at myself, people with head injuries didn't think it was very funny, and it was very insensitive of me to even do it. So I think you've got to be prepared to, you got to aim a lot at yourself, and you got to keep it pretty high level.
Now, there were Viagra jokes that were made.
Yeah, I think there may be one or two in there. Yeah, Leno had some Viagra jokes, I think, and because I said in a very honest way, I thought, because I'd been very outspoken on prostate cancer. I had the operation in 1991, and I know a lot of men don't talk about it, don't want to hear about it, but they should because they have a family or a business or whatever they owe it to their family. So we've sort of been trying to speak out on that. And to me, this seemed to be something that was also... men don't talk about impotence. There's millions and millions of men out there who need help. And I just sat on Larry King one night, made a statement that I thought I think I have certain credibility in that area as far as prostate cancer. It might be helpful to men. So, but some people picked it up and made jokes about it and even asked my wife about it and things of that kind.
Dan Aykroyd used to do impressions of you on Saturday
Night
Live. Oh, he was good.
Yeah, Saturday Night Live. He was great.
You liked his impression?
Yeah. I remember in 88 when they had the Bush-Dole debate or something.
Yeah.
I can't remember who played George Bush, but Aykroyd was pretty funny.
Now, I'm wondering if you ever saw a really good impression of you and noticed something that the impressionist was picking up on that you didn't realize you did, and you had to, go to a friend or a loved one and say, do I really do that?
Well, I've watched Norm Macdonald a few times. In fact, I was on Norm Macdonald on Saturday Night Live, and he came out with the same suit, the same tie, everything. We looked like twins, only he was much younger. And I always carry something in my right hand, so people won't grab my right hand and break it off. And he had a pencil in his right hand. He was all, so we had a great time. That was after the election, too. But and Aykroyd, I can't remember. I've watched him. I've told people he's going to have to lose a little weight if he's going to be Bob Dole, but he's going on to greater things. Yeah, I think you can sort of learn. I mean, you know, some people, I made a Visa commercial after the election. I had a lot of mail from people saying, Bob, if you'd have done that before the election, I'd have voted for you. I mean, people never see this side that they see maybe a side or somebody's told them a side or they see the negative ads. And I think most people, you know, like to think that you can go out and laugh at yourself and get other people to laugh. At the same time, you're a very serious person. So that message didn't get through in 96, but that's history. That's over. I'm doing other things now.
Do you think that most politicians have joke writers who write jokes for their speeches?
I think most now would. If they were going to give a major speech, let's say the gridiron dinner, which happens every year, as you know, in Washington,
mm-hmm.
and they pick one Republican and one Democrat, and they're supposed to get up and, you know, just knock the socks off the audience for about 8 minutes. Well, that's, you've got, you, most people would reach out for help. I mean, I remember I did that early on with Ted Kennedy, and he murdered me. I mean, my fellow never came through, and Ted had great stuff, and I was devastated.
What do you mean your fellow never came through?
Well, the guy I had helping me, I mean, he kept saying, oh, I want to do it. Yeah, don't, you got to be topical. Wait till the day of the event. I said, my God, I'm about to have a nervous breakdown. Anyway, our jokes weren't good. That's the point. And they weren't funny, and people didn't laugh. And you can imagine standing up there with all these, quote, people from across America, sort of the opinion makers and the editors and everybody else, and you're standing up there, and nobody's laughing. I mean, you feel like you died and it forgot to bury you or something. And it takes forever to get off that podium. And particularly since I followed Ted Kennedy, this is way back in 1980-something, but I've been on two or three times since and sort of recouped, but I've had to confess Ted wiped me out that night.
Did you have anybody working with you on delivery?
No, I just sort of learned the hard way. In fact, I started way back when I worked in a drugstore in high school in Russell, Kansas, and my dad was pretty good at these little quips and sort of wisecracks. And I remember when I first ran for Congress, my chairman said, now we don't need any more Jack Benny's in Congress, because I had a reputation, you know, trying to have a little fun, get people to laugh, get their, and a lot of the time you're trying to get people's attention.
Mm-hmm.
You go in to speak to 500 people at, say, 8 o'clock in the morning, the last thing they want to hear is some dull speech. And you got to wake them up. I mean, you know, they're still sleeping. And you got to sort of keep them there for a while, and then you can make the points you want to make in your speech and get out of there. But I think it, you know, Eisenhower, I mean, everybody, Churchill, I mean, I think one of my favorite stories of the book is where Lady Astor said to Churchill, if you were my husband, I would poison your coffee. And he said, if I were your husband, I would drink it. You know, so...
you got that. Right.
And Adlai Stevenson, you talk about a man with a wit, ran against Eisenhower. And Morris Udall, who ran for president as a Democrat years ago, was in the House, and they got a great... And, of course, Kennedy and Reagan, now, I don't know if they had writers, but they were good. They have good on delivery, President Kennedy, President Reagan. They probably were, you know, the best that I've known around.
I'm wondering, you know, you resigned from the Senate during the presidential campaign, and then you lost and you were out of the Senate. Are you sorry that you resigned? Do you wish you were still in the Senate?
Well, you kind of, you know, like anybody else when they leave their work, whether it's a labor union or some CEO or a lawyer, doctor, professional man or woman, whatever, teacher. You kind of think, you know, gee, how are they going to do it without me? And you kind of miss it. And I watch C-SPAN a lot, and I listen a lot. But I would say at this point, I thought about, should I do this? I thought I was making a powerful statement that I was willing to give up something, because I know there's a lot of cynicism in the country. And a lot of people think, well, Bob Dole, you know, he's going to run for president. He wants to keep the majority leader, and he wants to be in the Senate. But I want to make a statement that I was willing to risk something and devote my full time to running for the president. And if I lost, I lost. Not just the presidency, but my Senate seat and the longest-serving Republican majority leader's office. So I don't regret it. I mean, I knew at the time, you know, it was going to be uphill to win, but I also knew that it might convince some people that I was really... serious about what I was doing.
You were so used to winning elections. What did it feel like to lose, and to lose the big one?
Well, it didn't feel good, but it was a great experience, and we carried 19 states. We thought we were going to carry 23 or 24. We knew we had a real uphill climb, but you look back and you try to analyze it. And was it my fault? Was it somebody else's fault? Was it negative ads? Whatever it was. But having had the experience was certainly something that I never expected, coming from a little town in Kansas. But we didn't get there. That was a disappointment. And we worked very hard and didn't make it. But you can't rehash it the rest of your life. You've either got to move on, and still things I can do. I'm chairing the World War II Commission. We're trying to raise $100 million. We've raised about $35 to $40 million. We don't have a World War II memorial in Washington, D.C. President Clinton dedicated the site in 1995. We've worked out some controversy about the design, and I think that's the unfinished business of World War II, so I'm spending a lot of time doing that. We do a lot of public service announcements on prostate cancer and things of that kind, and plus my work in Bosnia on missing persons. So I've kept very busy, and I'm in the Bernard Lippert Law Firm with some of my friends, like Senator Mitchell and Senator Benson, people I worked with in the Senate. So I'm about as busy as I was. I just don't vote anymore.
You vote in the elections, just don't vote in the Senate.
Vote
you do vote in the elections, right?
I still vote in the elections.
Okay. Bob Dole, is there a good example of political wit from your book that you would like to leave us with?
Well, Jim, there are a lot of good examples. You know, one is, if you need a friend in Washington, get a dog. That was Truman.
That's good advice.
That's the way to end it, because the president's got him a dog, and I saw the dog Friday. Buddy's getting big. That's a big dog. I got little schnauzers, but Buddy can eat you out of house and home. So maybe that's a good way to leave it. If you really need a friend, and we all do in Washington from time to time, get a dog.
Is that why you have a dog with you on the cover of your book?
Yeah, my dog, yeah. In fact, he's here today, but poor little thing is getting pretty old. He's about 16, had trouble walking, and he's lost a lot of weight. But he's also the September dog on the Purina dog calendar, so he's having a big month.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Okie doke. Good luck.
Bob Dole has a new book called Great Political Wit. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews the new CD by Lauryn Hill of the Fugees. This is Fresh Air. As part of the R&B group The Fugees, Lauryn Hill won a Grammy for her cover of Roberta Flack's Killing Me Softly. She has a new solo album called The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill, on which she's the producer, writer, and lead vocalist. The album entered the charts at number one, setting a new first-week sales record for a female artist. Rock critic Ken Tucker admires the CD's range and ambition.
Now I don't, I used to.
Yeah. Pray the Father will forgive. At the age of 23, Lauryn Hill has already been an actress. She had a recurring role on the soap opera As the World Turns and appeared in Sister Act 2. She's proven to be the most arresting voice in the Fugees, managing to give a fresh urgency to a song that I and I bet a lot of people were pretty sick of, Roberta Flack's Killing Me Softly. And on The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill, she really stretches out, rapping with clipped intensity, and at various moments here, invoking older artists as diverse as Al Green, Stevie Wonder, and Bob Marley.
Beware the false motives of others. Be careful of those who pretend to be brothers. And you never suppose it's those who are closest to you.
What made Hill's version of Killing Me Softly so invigorating is that she drained all of Roberta Flack's melodrama and self-pity from the song the way a mechanic drains oil from a car. The same is true of nearly every cut on this CD. This is the sound of a very strong, independent-minded, even eccentric woman, one whose ambition, unlike those of so many young artists, never seems beyond her grasp. Just listen to the grand sweep and delicate memories evoked by Every Ghetto, Every City.
Writing my friends' names on my jeans with a marker. July 4th races outside Parker. Fireworks in Martin Stadium. The untouchable PSP. All the crazy Nick Guzzi. And coffee got away through Irvington. Hillside brings beef with the cops. Self-destruction record drops. And everybody's name was Muslim. Women producing sensations in 88. Attract the kids from out of state. Yo. And everybody used to do the wop.
Wop it out, wop it out, wop it out.
Jack your body. Jack. Not a Bismarck used to amp up the party. I wish those days they didn't stop.
If the music there reminds you of Stevie Wonder's Living in the City, well, Hill has made the style her own with its vividly precise memories of childhood. She then takes that 70s soul style and creates what I think is a minor masterpiece on the same theme, called Everything is Everything. This education of Lauryn Hill is marred slightly by spoken word conversational sections at the end of some cuts that grow tiresome over the course of repeated listenings. But that's a minor flaw. The miseducation of the title refers in part to Hill's disillusionment with pure romance. This is the chronicle of a young woman's growth into wise maturity. There may not be a smarter CD released all year.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed the new album, The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Bob Purdick is our engineer. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
You're just too good to be true. Can't take my eyes off of you. You be like heaven to touch. I wanna hold you so much. At long last, love has arrived. And I thank God I'm alive. You're just too good to be true.
heart and the way that I stare. There's nothing else to compare. The sight of you leaves me weak. There are no words left to speak. But if you feel like I feel, please let me know that it's real. You're just too good to be true. Can't take my eyes off you.
I want to.
Take my eyes off of you. You'd be like heaven to touch. I wanna hold you so.